Mick is our moderator today. He is the partner in charge of the Waltham office and co-chair of WilmerHale's emerging company practice. He's also the co-chair of the WilmerHale Energy and Clean Tech Group. He counsels entrepreneurs and emerging companies throughout their life cycle, so for business formation, governance issues, compensation, straight through IPOs and beyond. He's organized dozens of IPOs and acquisitions. His industry experience includes software, mobile, telecommunications, storage, semiconductors, network security, e-commerce, social media, you know, the usual suspects. He's in the Energy and Clean Tech Group. He's co-chair of this group. He has represented a number of companies like A123, BandGap, BioOils, Carbon Flow, Carbon Neutral. He was recognized for his private equity and venture capital investment practice in America's Leading Lawyers for Business. He has been named one of best lawyers in America in the area of venture capital law, and he was named a New England super lawyer in 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2012. So,
I don't know what happened.
No, yeah. So let me put this on you. You know what?
I'm trying another one.
Put it here.
Okay.
Oops.
Okay. That work?
Yeah, that'll work. All right, you're on.
All right, great. Thank you, Larry. Thank you all for coming. So as Larry said, I'm Mick Bain. I've been my focus has been for the last 13 years really working with early stage companies and venture capital firms. I've been practicing law for 20 years at WilmerHale for most of that time. Initially my focus was, you know, pretty general. I worked with lots of early stage companies, a lot of investors, a lot of investment banks, a lot of public companies. And then I actually went in-house for a little while during what we all might remember as the dot-com bubble, the first one anyway, and worked at a company that you all might have heard of, which is called CMGI. And there I did a lot of work with...
You didn't look like you're that old.
Yeah. It definitely aged me, but did a lot of international JV work as well as a lot of venture work at CMGI. And that was a pretty interesting experience for the reasons you might be able to guess, but also just as a lawyer to a counselor to companies. I went back to Hale & Dorr after that experience, and you know, that's when I made the shift in focus and said, you know, what I really enjoyed about that experience was working with the entrepreneurs, working with their boards of directors, and really being at the forefront of helping them make good practical business decisions. Because one of the interesting things about you as a lawyer is if you're an entrepreneur, you probably, even if you're a serial entrepreneur, you know, work with a handful of companies over the course of your lifetime. If you're a board member, probably a handful, 10, 12 companies maybe over the course of your lifetime. A VC might work with a handful of companies each year. I have the benefit of working with, you know, hundreds of companies over the course of, you know, on an annual basis. And so what I've learned is, you know, I've seen a lot of companies that have really interesting, great ideas that have turned into not so successful exits. I've seen some mediocre ideas turn into some really gangbuster exits. And so you end up seeing a lot of the same decisions over and over and over again, or at least issues over and over again, and how people approach them. And that's what I really like to do, is help people understand from my experience, hey, these are the things that companies have done that I've worked with in the past that have worked well, and these are the things that haven't. And one of the most challenging parts of working with a company is, or one of the most important things, is helping them raise capital. And you know, a lot of that is strategic. There's a lot of strategy involved. There's a lot of legal issues involved as well. But it's obviously a real important point in the company's life cycle. So when Larry asked me to come here today to talk about trends in venture capital, I thought to myself, well, you know, that's a pretty broad topic. And we can talk about lots of different things. We can talk about, you know, deal trends, where the money's going, who's investing in what types of companies, geographically, sector-wise. And we can certainly cover some of that. But what I thought I'd do is, knowing the audience, is try to focus on a handful of issues that I think are probably things that are most relevant or most interesting, that would be most interesting to you guys. And my hope is that we can make it pretty interactive, and if you want to focus on one thing and do a deep dive, we can do that, and if you want to, you know, cover something else, we can do that as well. So what I thought I'd do initially is just sort of go through at a high level the topics that I wanted to, that I thought would be interesting for you to cover, and if you have others, feel free to yell. And then we'll circle back and we'll take a deeper dive on a couple of them that I think, if I'm a board member, are most interesting. So with that, I think I'll just pass this out. That'll cover the, sort of give you a sense as to what the topics are. And again, I'm not going to go too deep on these initially. I'm going to try to hit them all, just sort of give you the highlights of what the issues are and what we're seeing. And then, again, circle back. But if you have questions or you want to, you know, jump in, even at this initial phase, please do so. So one of the things that has become more and more prevalent we're seeing in the last few years is the issue of founder liquidity, or liquidity for the common holders, right? Historically, what we saw most of the time was, you know, the founders get liquid when everybody else gets liquid. You know, the company's either got to go public or there's got to be a sale of the company in order for people to get out. That's starting to change a little bit. And I think there's, in part probably because companies are in many cases staying private longer. But it's also, I think, being driven not only by the desire of the founders to get liquidity, but by the funds themselves. As you probably all know, most venture funds have a lifetime of 10 years. And so as the companies continue to sort of stay private for a longer period of time, there's a lot of pressure by the venture firms themselves, by their LPs and their governing documents to receive some liquidity. And there's also been the development of more and more funds that want to make later stage transactions, whether private equity funds, growth equity funds, or even you know, specialized venture funds that want to invest in later stage companies. The cap table, if they just made a new capital infusion, won't justify that occurring because of the dilution. And so one way they can solve for that, you know, dilution problem is to invest in the company, maybe leave a little bit in there, maybe not leave any of it in there, depending on the company's circumstances and what it needs, and use the rest to give some liquidity to the existing shareholders. So that's one thing that we've seen a lot of, and those deals are, they're fun, they're complex, and they have a lot of challenges, including if you're a board member, just in terms of your fiduciary responsibility, in terms of thinking about what you should do and whether you should approve that transaction. The second topic relates to changes in the law, and a lot of people probably have heard of some of these changes. A year and a half ago at this point, the Congress adopted what's called the Jobs Act, which stands for Jumpstart Our Business. It was what Jobs stands for. And the Congress adopted a bunch of rules or a new statute that provides for changes to the securities laws to try to make it easier for people to start companies. That's the idea. There's a whole host of regulations under the Jobs Act. One of the most prominent that people have heard of publicly is the concept of crowdfunding, where you can effectively, historically, right, you can't raise money from too many people without it constituting a public offering, and once it constitutes a public offering, you as the issuer of the securities have to register your shares with the SEC, effectively go public, right? And if you're a startup obviously you're not ready to go public, but it can be challenging to raise capital, and it with technology, with the advent of the internet, thanks Al Gore, you can reach a lot more people today than you could historically, and so the idea is, can we create a structure, a funding structure, that will make Congress, the government, comfortable that people won't be committing fraud, but we're allow people who are starting companies or looking to raise capital access to a broader pool of capital. So crowdfunding is an area that is getting a lot of attention. Now, those rules were supposed to be adopted by the SEC promptly after the Congress adopted the statute, and as I said, we're a year and a half later, and they just promulgated the proposed rules in September. They're not final yet, but they're coming. And I'm happy to talk a little bit deeper dive again when we sort of circle back on that if you have questions about the Jobs Act and crowdfunding. I think, though, that for most of the companies that we work with, most venture-backed companies, it's ultimately not going to prove to be a viable funding option, right? So it's an interesting concept, and I think for certain types of businesses it might actually be very beneficial and viable, but for most companies that we work with it won't be, in part because of the limitations on the amount of money you can raise, as well as the ongoing obligations to provide financial disclosure to your shareholders, and just the costs associated with doing that. The statute or the rules also allow for some leniency on what historically was prohibited by the rules related to general solicitation. So let's assume we're not raising capital in a crowdfunding situation, but we're raising funding in a traditional venture style private placement, typically through Rule 506 of Regulation D. That rule historically, and still does, prohibit you from engaging in what's called general solicitation, basically advertising. And the SEC said, well, let's actually allow for that. Let's allow for some general solicitation. So, like a lot of good things, with the one hand they giveth and the other hand they taketh away, they said, okay, you can do general solicitation, but if you do, you have a bunch of other hoops and hurdles you have to jump through. Specifically for the general solicitation rules, they require that you, as the issuer, take some additional steps to confirm that the investors are accredited, which doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but they didn't give us a lot of detail on what we actually need to do. We do have to get your W-2s, your tax returns. They gave a couple of examples, four, but they kind of left it up to interpretation. So, if you're now raising capital in if you're an investor, any of you are investing in private companies, and you get this new question about, hey, can you provide me this additional information? That's probably why. If the company is relying on Rule 506 but didn't engage in any general solicitation, then you don't have to worry about that. The old rule of just, getting the person to certify, make a representation, that's good enough. And then lastly, in the with the SEC rules,
how is your investor yourself? How do you get any assurance that they haven't done solicitation?
Yeah, it's a good question. The same way you did before, right? Which is you include in the documents a representation that says that we haven't engaged in any general solicitation. If it turns out they did, that they violated the securities law, you have the same remedy you've always had, which is basically a rescission right on that transaction, right? But as an accredited investor, it's your responsibility to ask, the right diligence questions. So you should ask that question. You should make sure there's a rep in the document, right? And then lastly, they said, look, if you want to, remember that they wanted to help raise capital, but at the same time, they always want to try to restrict your, they want to be a little bit more paternalistic in terms of what you do as a company. And so they adopted what's called these bad actor rules, which if you have any of your officers or your directors, if you have a promoter or someone who's helping you raise capital, a broker, or any of your significant shareholders, 20% or more, were committed some bad acts, basically violated the securities laws ever in their life, then you can't rely on this rule, on Rule 506 at all. right? Not just the general solicitation piece. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of plays out. Because again, if you're investors, if you're VCs, if you're board members, you're now going to be asked to make some sort of representations, certifications to the companies on which you're serving on these boards that you haven't committed these bad acts. So again, you're not necessarily exposed to any additional liability than you were before, but you are going to be asked to sign those certifications. So you're going to start seeing those show up in your inbox, and that's why. The biggest question mark about those rules, not to dive into too deep of detail on this, is just what it means to be a 20% holder, right? Because if you probably know, if you've invested in companies, you've all signed a voting agreement that says we all agree that we'll vote our shares to elect this slate of board members, et cetera. And so there's a lot of debate now in the legal circles as to whether or not every single person that signed that voting agreement should be aggregated together, such that if you own 1% of the stock, you are deemed to be a 20% holder because together you represent more than 20%. So even if you're below 20%, you might start seeing these certification requirements come your way. So that's the Jobs Act, and that's like, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I don't think, other than slowing things down a little bit and requiring some additional certifications and representations, that we're really going to see much different happen in venture financings as a result of the Jobs Act. I don't think the crowdfunding stuff is actually going to have any real impact. It's not going to be used. The amount of money that you can raise is just too small. It's $1 million. And for many one individual, it's pretty limited. It's like $5,000 if you have less than $100,000 of income, or it's 10% of your income if you have more than that. So there's some, you know, significant limitations. The next one I wanted to highlight is use of convertible debt. And this is an area, I don't know if I'd call it it's not necessarily a new trend, but in especially in pre-A round companies, seed round businesses, it's pretty common to raise capital through convertible debt. And the way that works is, you know, I invest $100,000 in the company. The company gives me a promissory note and says that at the time of the next round of funding, my promissory note will convert into whatever security those next guys get. The professionals, right? The VCs get. And I get to convert at a discount. Typically the discount's like 20%. So that's not new. That's a structure that we've used a long time because, well, I'm just an angel and I don't know what the value is, and I'm just as likely to get it right as I am to get it wrong. And ultimately, if I negotiate a bunch of rights and then the VCs get more superior rights, then that's not really beneficial to me either. So there's some real benefits to pushing this off till later on. So that's not new, but what is new is, sort of over the last three, four years, we started to see people saying, well, what happens if the company raises money not at, you know, a typical A round valuation of $4 or $5 to $6 million, but raises it at some crazy California valuation of like 100? And, you know, if the company also, the company might stay, you know, with technology, you can build a company and, you know, might not need to raise a lot of money for a long period of time. So if it's one thing if that note converts 6 months after my investment and I get a 20% pop on my investment, that sounds pretty good. But if the company's sticking around as a private company before it raises that institutional round for 18 months or 2 years, and all I get is a 20% return, I took a lot bigger risk, and the valuation isn't $5 million, it's $50 million, that's not as good of a deal. And so we started to see what creeping into these deals, what's referred to as a cap on the valuation. So it's, you know, I'll convert into the next round valuation minus my discount, provided that if the valuation exceeds X, I convert at that valuation, right? So it's a way to protect the seed investor from the sort of real ramp up in valuation. The problem that we end up seeing is if the valuation is really, really high, you still have a big problem as the company, because while that does protect the investor, the seed investor, the way that it works is I would get Series A preferred stock, because that's what the VCs get. I get, let's say I had a cap of $10 million, but the company raises capital at $100 million. Well, okay, I get to invest, my share, my note converts at a $10 million valuation, but I get the same security that the guys got at the $100 million valuation. And the liquidation preference at the $100 million valuation is a lot higher than it is at the $10 million valuation. And so you end up creating a situation where you're stacking a lot of liquidation preference on top of the company's cap table in a unanticipated way if the valuation starts to really ramp up. So you have to be careful about that. And what we're seeing is if that happens, sometimes you see some alternative structure where you basically give the note holder preferred for their $100,000, right, the Series A preferred. But for the other shares that they would get, the other 90% of their shares, you give them common, something without a liquidation preference. Or you give them another series of preferred without any liquidation preference. So they're not double dipping, if you will. They're getting an increased number of shares. That was what they bargained for, but they're not getting that plus an increased liquidation preference.
Every time I've seen this situation where the value was high, either liquidation, it's a combination of liquidation preferences being cut, so usually there's A stock and A1 stock, or E1 and A2, whatever you want to call it, and they renegotiate the cap where there's no deal.
Yep, and that's right. So you end up seeing
the bargain you thought you had is off the table, or the $4 million doesn't come in.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, if I'm an angel investor, it's sort of like you have a gun to your head, right? Because if the company can't raise the capital, then, you know, what good's my investment? But it does give you, I mean, there's a lot of things like that in venture deals, right? Registration rights. You know, I've been practicing for 20 years. I've never really seen them exercised. Redemption rights, the same thing, right? But it gives me something to negotiate from, a place to negotiate from. But you're right. It's likely, or it's not that uncommon that those things are going to get renegotiated. I did a deal, that fact pattern I gave you, where the cap was 10 million. We did the financing at 100. That's a real deal. And the new investors did exactly what you said, right? The notes didn't provide for, well, the other 90% of your shares get no liquidation preferences. They didn't say that. But the deal that was cut was, if you want us to put this money in at $100 million valuation, that's what's going to happen.
Well, or the cap goes into the junior securities.
Right, right.
You end up getting common.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and one way or the other, right? The point is that, so if it goes from 10 to 100, people have their eye on that ball. If it goes from 10 to, you know, 15 or 20 or 30, sometimes they miss out on that issue and they're just like, okay, I got to issue more shares, but then they don't see the actual impact on the liquidation preferences when they do the waterfall.
I just negotiated with a state of Virginia agency who likes convertible notes. That's the way they make their investment. Well, what they said is, they didn't care about a cap. What they cared about was they didn't have to convert if another round came in and the valuation jump was too high.
Yeah.
That they would stay there, which then really sticks a gun to your head, because now they're senior to the money coming in.
Right.
And that money coming in is not going to want to have that.
That's right. And we always make sure that the notes are they automatically convert.
But if they,
and for that reason, because no VC wants to come in, put $5 million into the company, and have $1.5 million go out, right, to pay off the note holders, right? Hey, the business plan says you need $5 million. That's why we got that number, right? So you're right. That's a problem if you have the ability of the note holder to force, you know, either not convert or force repayment. Yeah, that could be an issue. So that's kind of the biggest issue we're seeing in the convertible debts thing. And especially with more and more of these, the terms are starting to be really variable, because, you know, you end up having historically, you know, the number of seed investors, which is one of the things I wanted to talk about, the number of seed investors, the number of seed deals has just grown astronomically, right?
The VCs won't touch them.
Yeah, here, I'll pass this around a little bit. Yeah, exactly. That's another piece, right? So another trend, right? The what we used to see as an A round, right? They really, you know, used to be an A round, you oftentimes would do off a, you know, it's a great idea and a great team. Now it's a great idea and a great team and some traction,
right?
That used to be a B round, right? And so the VCs oftentimes don't want to come in until you've got that. And in order to get that, you need some money. So, you know, the amount of seed capital, the dollars have actually not gone up significantly in seed rounds, but the numbers have gone up tremendously. You know, from
$25,000 investors out there.
Yep.
Very few $100,000.
That's right. You know, just I'm passing around some stats to take a look at, but you know, the what did I have? Between 2001 and 2006, there were an average of 110 seed rounds. The figure doubled between 2007 and 2010, and then doubled again, so up to 428 rounds annually in 2011 and 2012.
You talked about a seed round that could be either convertible debt or a...
That's right. It could be a priced equity deal. That's right. Now, the big issue, though, is like, okay, that there's 428... Let's assume those are separate companies for a second, right? They may or may not be, but let's assume that they are. Which is
Reg D registration software.
These are Reg D deals, right? So they seed round deals. You know, Joel, is that your name there? Yeah, Joel's starting his company, and he's going to go out and raise $500,000, right? And he's going to do it from a bunch of, you know, smart and wealthy people, and they're going to write checks of, you know, $25,000 to $100,000 each, and that type of round. That's oftentimes what it is. It's also sometimes we're seeing more and more venture guys getting into the seed stage, but they're different types of venture guys. Like Atlas is really active in the seed stage, right? And there's actually some funds like Founder Collective that are. Yep.
Third Rock. That's a lot.
But there's not 428 A round checks to go around.
Right.
Right? So that what people refer to as the Series Seed crunch or the A round crunch, right? Where it's like, okay, there's all these great, you know, startups that have gotten to from point A to point B, but how many of them are really going to raise that A round? That's where the rubber meets the road. It's going to be really challenging, I think, for many of those companies to raise a significant round of capital. Yeah.
From a capitalist perspective, that there are so many young startups going crazy in these seed rounds, is that a warning sign? You're talking to a startup who they talk to 8 or 9 individuals, $20,000 check here, $30,000 check here. Does your capitalist tend to back off?
So they call that the spray and pray strategy, right? I'm going to invest, you know, if I'm a venture capitalist and I'm investing $50,000 checks in, you know, 100 different companies, there's no way I'm going to write follow-on checks for all of those, but I'm making a lot of bets is really what that is. Now, they'll generally tell you that's not what they're doing. They're being really careful, and they're not investing in just anybody, right? They are doing some diligence, but they're generally not taking board seats, et cetera, because A, they don't have time to monitor all those, and B, they don't want the liability if they're not going to spend the time. But we have to definitely, there's some pros and cons to raising your seed money from, on the one hand, angels, and on the other hand, venture guys, right? With angels, you know, they generally like to invest in companies they actually understand, think technologies they know about. They might be really helpful. They might be more likely to be a mentor to you as a first-time entrepreneur. They're also more likely to be kind of a pain in the butt, right? So that could be, you have to do your diligence on what sort of investor that is. They're also not going to write that next check, right? So when you, a year from closing your seed round, you're going to be out on the road pounding the pavement trying to, you know, open the doors again to raise capital without probably that much, you know, more help than you had at the time of the seed round. In contrast, if you take that money from a venture firm, that venture firm can write the check for you. They probably want to lead the A round, which is good and bad, by the way, right? Because you're now kind of beholden to them. It's a little harder to negotiate against them when they're already an investor in your company. But the biggest negative, and they can open a lot of doors for you that maybe the angel can. But the biggest potential negative is if they say no, right? If they say, you're not one of the ones that gets my $5 million A-round check. Because now, not only are you out there running around trying to raise capital from a bunch of VCs, but every VC that you go talk to is going to say, how come the investor that knows you the best, that invested in your seed round, isn't investing in you? Right? So that kind of black mark, that the potential for that black mark. So if everything goes great and they invest in you, okay, all's great. But there's a potential for a significant downside. So you have to be really careful. There's some pros and cons to both approaches.
So you mix some of the angel groups, though, are writing second checks. Because I belong to Cherry Stone Angels down in Rhode Island.
Yep.
We write a lot of
stuff. Yeah, you're right, and I should have clarified that. So a lot of the angel groups, you know, Cherry Stone, Hub Angels, Common Angels, you know, right, Launchpad, those guys will oftentimes write checks into the A round, right? They like to maintain or keep, you know, maybe even increase their ownership percentage.
Right.
It's the individual angels that I guess I was referring to. It's a little harder, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think that the angel group, right, if they don't carry that potential for a black mark, right? If they don't participate in that next round, people kind of go, okay, well, that's because they're an angel group. It's not because they think there's anything wrong with you. So, you know, there's a little bit of a twist between, you know, the angel versus the venture guys. And there's kind of those three categories, individual angels, angel groups, and venture firms. So
better off if you can get the angel group to invest right out of the blocks. They'll stay with you.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there's been some amazing, you know, angel group stories and people and I've worked with a lot of companies that have been really happy raising money from angel groups. They also present their own challenges, right? You know, even though you're typically investing, your investor is an angel group, that you still end up, I don't know how your group's structured, but you end up having, you know, 10 or 15 or 30 different shareholders, and you got to chase those guys around every time you need signatures. And angels also, whether part of a group or otherwise, VCs tend to be a little bit more predictable, right? They have you can do your diligence and find out how big their fund is, how long their fund has been around. You can do your research on the track record of that particular general partner at the fund. With any individual investor, regardless of sort of where they're from, you know, their own personal circumstances can impact you much differently, right? If I'm an investor in your company and then, you know, I have a family emergency and I need my money for something else, I'm not going to write that check, right? So it's a little more unpredictable. So I don't want to run out of time, but we talked about a bunch of these things. The one thing that we didn't talk about that as board members, that is pretty important, is a recent development. Now, it goes back to 2009, so it's not really a recent development, but there was a case back in 2009 that was decided about, or a lawsuit that was brought in 2009 about what your fiduciary responsibilities are as board members when you're authorizing a sale of a venture-backed company. In that case, which is called Trados, was recently finally decided back in August. And I'm not going to bore you with all, this is the case, right? This is the decision of the court. But I think this is, if I'm a board member of a venture-backed company, if I'm thinking about becoming a board member of a venture-backed company, this is probably the area that I'm most interested in, because it has the biggest potential to be to result in personal liability for me. So usually when I say personal liability, everybody perks up. I'll give you two or three minutes on the facts of this case. And I think it's going to, if any of you have served on boards, and it sounds like many of you have, of venture-backed companies, I think the fact pattern is going to sound very similar. It's very familiar to you. So this company was founded in 1984. Okay, that part doesn't sound that familiar. It was a desktop translation technology. They were kind of self-funded for a long, long time. And right in I think in 1999, they decided they were going to raise their first venture capital. That part almost doesn't matter. The point is that they raised a couple rounds of venture capital. They grew the company to, like, you know, 13 million revenue a year. Then they went to 20 million revenue per year. They hit a couple of bumps in the road. It dropped back down to a point where they were losing money. And the VCs started to get tired, right? The VCs said to themselves, you know, they looked at the, they sort of did a landscape of the market, they hired an investment banker. The investment banker went around and said, you know, there's 28, I think, possible, 28 potential buyers for this company. And they went around and they talked to most of them, and they said, well, I think that a valuation for this company could be in the range of, this is the investment banker talking, anywhere from 20 to $170 million, right? Thank you very much, investment banker, right? So they started knocking on some doors, and all the doors closed. One potential buyer got, you know, signed an NDA and said, give me your financials, and as soon as they saw the financials, they said, we're not interested. So now the VCs, you know, are really starting to feel like, you know, we got to kind of unload this thing, right? We don't want to put any more money in it. And at this stage, even if we grew it, you know, to double or triple the revenue, it's probably not going to be, it's never going to really be a big return. We'll be lucky to get our money out. They actually changed management, and the new management came in and said, we want more money, right? Usually that's not uncommon, right? The new management comes in and they say, well, if you want to hire me, we want you to put some more money in the company. The investor said, no, we're not going to give you any more money. You can go out and get a little bit of venture debt if you'd like, but we're not going to give any more money. Just try to like dress this thing up so we can sell it, and we'll put in a management incentive plan in place, which is another common thing, which is basically a contract that the company has with management that says when you sell the company, we'll give you a certain percentage of the company. In this case, they gave them 13% of the sale proceeds. It was this kind of a scale, and so that's what management did. They went out and they tried to build the company, and they actually righted the ship. The company started doing better and better and better. And one of the potential buyers that they had talked to before came back and said, hey, we're really interested in buying you guys. And oh, by the way, one of your competitors just got acquired by the other most likely buyer. So they're probably off the table as a buyer. So now these guys are feeling like, okay, we've got the ship righted. We can sell this thing, get out from under, you know, our problem, and we can call it a day. So the board approves the sale of the company. They sell it for $57 million. The liquidation preferences in the company were 60. So they sold it for under the liquidation preferences. So what does that mean? What it means is the preferred walked away with $52 million, or I guess it was $50 million, and the common walked away with about 7. I might have those numbers a little bit off. 52 and 50 and 7, I think, is what it was. So they sold it for 59, just under the liquidation preferences. So the common got nothing, right? Does that sound familiar to you guys? Has anybody ever heard of a story like that? I see those every day.
I've heard stories of that, but in those cases, management needed to go with the company, the buyer wanted management. Mm-hmm. So the buyer stuck a gun to the preferred holders and said, you will give some of the money to the common because we need those guys.
To the common or to the management? Management here walked away with $7 million.
Right.
So they weren't feeling so bad.
Investors.
They weren't feeling so bad.
Non-affiliated.
The guys that were feeling bad were the guys that were no longer management,
well,
right?
That they got crushed out.
They got booted.
Right.
The new management came in a year later. They sold the company less than a year later, and those guys got nothing, right?
Right.
And so, the common, those former common stockholders, sued the company and said that the board of directors owed a fiduciary responsibility separate and apart from the preferred holders, and owed a fiduciary responsibility to the common holders to not just get a better price, but basically, this is where it gets interesting, to wait, right? It's not that you didn't get the best price today. It's just that if you had waited, right, the company actually had been righted. It didn't need any more money. If you had just waited, you could have gotten a better deal and we could have gotten something. And that raises a big question. It's like, well, when can you actually approve the sale of a company? Right? I mean, I could always wait and maybe get more later on. And so here are the board of directors. By the way, the board had seven members, three venture capitalists, two members of management, and then two other guys. But the court said one of the other guys wasn't really independent because he was a small investor in an LP in one of the funds, and that fund had also had him on a couple of other boards. So he basically was kind of like their guy, right? So again, that's not that uncommon either. And the really challenging and difficult thing about this is the court basically said, look, in this situation, you board members owe a fiduciary duty to the common holders. You should have gotten an independent board committee. That never happens in a venture-backed company, right? There are no independent directors, right? And they didn't like this management incentive plan, which, hell, I got those in almost every company I have, right? That is, you know, kind of questionable as to whether they're going to have a rocket ship trajectory. And they said, so the court said, look, you guys, the claim was that you board members breach your fiduciary duty of loyalty. And the reason that's important is the duty of loyalty, because you board members had a personal interest. You either were going to get money for your preferred or through this management incentive plan. So it was not a disinterested transaction. And that's almost every fact pattern of every sale of a venture-backed company. And why is that important? Because when you have a duty of loyalty case, the indemnity provisions in the company's charter probably are voided. The liability proceeds, the D&O insurance probably doesn't cover that. And the exculpation provisions of the charter aren't available to you either. Delaware law doesn't allow you to be exculpated from liability if you breach your fiduciary duty of loyalty. So it's really interesting that in the sale of a venture-backed company, which fact pattern is pretty close to the sale of almost every other venture-backed company, that could be the situation you find yourselves in as board members, where your own personal liability is, you know, at stake, and the protections that you thought were in place might not be available. So I'll let you think about that, and then we'll talk about some of the takeaways and some of the ways you might be able to help yourself.
I said before I needed to pay attention. But if the same dynamic you could wait always to get us theoretically a better price if you're on a trajectory or whatever.
Right.
That could be determined. How would you determine the damages of
good case? Great question. And it didn't get there, so I don't know the answer to that. One of the distinguishing factors So basically the court said is like there's three scenarios, right? And what you don't want to find yourself in is this scenario, which is the middle one, right? There's like the rocket ship scenario where everything's going great and nobody cares because everyone's going to, basically at that point your interests are all aligned, right? Maybe if you have participating preferred, you've got some differences, but in general the preferred convert and the common and the preferred get paid the same thing. In the total disaster scenario, right, at that point it's kind of moot and you're just trying to preserve as much value, probably for the creditors at that point. It's this middle case, which, you know, is oftentimes the case. So what I think you want to do, and the court was very clear that they were making this case and this judgment on the basis of these facts. So you want to do is try to figure out as many ways as possible you can change your facts that don't look like this. One of the, I think, the most important facts is this company could have kept going. They didn't need more money. And that was one of the arguments. It's like, if you just waited, things could have turned around, right? Now, again, they could have been wrong, right? The market could have completely collapsed or whatever. But it wasn't like many cases, many of my clients, it's like, look, the VCs said they won't fund anymore, and we're not going to make payroll next month if we don't sell this thing. That wasn't the fact pattern here, and maybe that's enough to make it a little bit different. I think you're still in the duty of loyalty situation, but the duty of loyalty, and the other piece I should mention is, when you're in duty of loyalty, the burden is on you, the defendant, to prove that the deal was fair. Right? That's the difference. If you're in duty of care, then the burden's on the other party, the plaintiff, to prove that you, as a board member, acted in a grossly negligent fashion. Very, very different standards, right? Both the burden of proof is different, and then also what you actually have to prove is very different. I think one of the biggest issues is, because of this case, it just makes it more likely that that common stockholders are going to look for, this is kind of a precedent. It gave them a way to say, hey, this is, our facts are just like Trados. We're gonna sue you. So I think we can expect.
Then you gotta go get an investment banker to do a fairness opinion.
So that's it. So okay, great question. So they had an investment banker, right? But they fired that investment banker, and then they hired the management. So maybe if they had an investment banker all the way through. Most investment bankers don't like to give fairness opinions in private companies, because, you know, it's not like a public company deal where you can, you know, public company comparables and you can look at the stock price.
You're going to protect yourself.
And so maybe that's one way. You could get a, so what can we do, right? You can change your facts. Yeah.
When the investment banker early on rendered an opinion, it was 20 to 170?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that wasn't before they actually went and shopped.
Yeah, that wasn't their fairness opinion.
That's not a fairness.
My question is, well, what if there still is a significant change in the investment bank? Does the investment banker necessarily come back?
Well, then if you were a disinterested board member, all right, so you're not one of the common holders, one of the preferred holders, you are the independent board member. All right, you need. And you're in this middle ground where the liquidation preference isn't covered. The only way you can protect yourself and not be personally liable is to have an expert opinion that says the deal is fair to all the securities holders.
Which is really hard for them to do when the common get nothing, right? When the common get nothing, because that's what a fairness opinion says.
That's right.
So I think getting a fairness opinion is very challenging.
That would bracket that point where the common gets nothing. And so the issue is, well, it may have an intrinsic value above that point, but we, at this point, cannot find that buyer.
Yeah.
The answer is, you know what you do? You resign before that deal closes.
Well,
or the vote comes. No, seriously. That is, you resign and you got voted on.
That all the board members are liable, irrespective of whether they had an interest or not?
Well, so that's a question. It's basically the people who are probably most at risk are management board members. But the VC board members, for sure, are also, you know, subject to. And why is that? Because, well, the VC directors probably have some additional protection, right? Their fund might indemnify them, right? Management doesn't have those sorts of protections. What can we do, right? What can you do as board members in this situation? I think that, first of all, again, try to distinguish the facts. And your facts, every way that you possibly can in your deal, right? Hey, we didn't have the luxury of just waiting. That's an important fact. The management incentive plan, the court looked at the way that was structured, and they didn't like it. Because what it said was, for every dollar you as member of management get under the management incentive plan, if you also are going to get a dollar as a result of your common stock, you reduce the payout under the management incentive plan dollar for dollar. And what they said was that effectively means, if I'm management, I'm just going to try to maximize the management incentive plan, and I'm not going to worry about trying to increase it beyond that, because I don't really get anything, right? So they didn't like that fact. The common got nothing. The common got nothing. And that happens a lot. But one thing we oftentimes will see is, if you are going to do a deal and the common are going to get nothing, is you amend the charter and reduce your liquidation preference. Give the common something. Give them a little bit, just to make them appease them effectively. That's another thing you can do. And back to the fairness opinion, while you might not be able to get a banker to give you a fairness opinion, you can do some analysis of valuation and try to support your position. So for example, in this case, the accruing dividends were 8%, which is pretty common. The anticipated growth rate of the company was 3%. So an argument was made, or can be made, and was after the fact, that even if you waited, the liquidation preferences were going to outgrow the growth of the company, right? So that was another another thing. And then the last cautionary tale here for you guys is one of the things the court didn't like here was that the VCs were, there was a lot of communication among the VCs, both within their funds themselves and across funds, about, you know, the fact that, and it's not uncommon, right? Hey, this company's, you know, seems like it's turning around. We got some good management in place. But even with those guys, you know, this is, so Sequoia was an investor. It's never going to be a big enough deal for us. We should just get out, right? That, the court said, well, there, your interests are different, right, than the common stockholders. You just want to get out, move on, and find another investment. Whereas the common holders are trying to maximize their investment in this case. And so a lot of that chatter, you got to be careful, like that back and forth about what the fact that we are venture funds and, you know, if this one's only a single, then it's not really worth our time. Let's go focus on the one that could be a home run. You got to be careful about that sort of stuff. And then lastly, as a buyer, if you're representing, if you're on a board of a buyer that's looking to buy a venture-backed company, do your diligence on the target's process, right? That, you know, we always do due diligence on the company's assets and the business and the contracts and the IP and all that stuff, but how did they get to the decision to make, to decide to sell to you? And if that company is in a trade-off situation, you gotta be careful about buying that company, because guess what? All those directors of the Trados company came after them to try to make them. They actually won this case because the court said the price turned out to be fair. That's what the court ultimately decided. But they spent like $3.5 million of legal fees that they want the buyer now to pay. So do your diligence as a buyer on the type of process that the target has undergone to decide to sell to you. So. That's the, to me, of all the trends and things that we're seeing in venture capital and how we raise money, if I'm a board member, that's the one I'm most focused on. Is, you know, when I'm on the board and I'm thinking about my company selling to somebody else, I want to understand this process a little more than I used to.
If you put aside the conflict of interest for a minute,
yeah,
where does the fiduciary responsibility lie to the preferreds? So here you have a situation where the liquidation preference is $10 million. You can sell the thing for $8 million. The commie gets nothing. The board decides to wait, and the value goes down to $3 million. And you get sued by the preferred guys and says you should have gotten out when you could have gotten out.
Yeah. So if there's no conflict of interest, then the standard is, as I said, totally different. So the standard in that case is what's called the business judgment rule. And the business judgment rule, basically, a court says, we're going to assume, as long as you were reasonably informed about the business, we're going to assume that you guys acted, we're not going to second guess our business judgment for you, the board, right? So unless the plaintiff, in your hypothetical, the preferred holders, can show that you are grossly negligent in making your decision to sell or not to sell.
I don't know if it's gross negligence or not. I only know the minutes say, The common's not going to get anything. We don't like those guys anyhow, so let's wait.
Yeah, so if the record said that, then I'd write better minutes. But the decision to sell or not to sell in that circumstance, I think, is not going to be something that's going to subject to the liability.
What if the minutes said, we see a risk that the value of the company is going to decrease, and you capture that as a minute? It's not a prediction, it's just we're seeing that risk.
So, well, again, we're pretty careful about how specific we get in the minutes, but, you know, it could still be in the board book or something like that, some record. Again, I think if there's not a conflict of interest, if there's not a personal interest in the transaction, which, by the way, is never the case in a venture-backed company. They always have an interest, so it's a hypothetical that probably isn't ever going to happen. If you have an independent majority of the board making that decision, and they decide to wait, even though that they were told that it might go down, the court generally won't second guess that judgment.
Thank you very much, Mick.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I just want to stay in if you can talk to the group about this or any other subject, please feel free to do so. Those who want to leave, feel free to do so. Thank you.